Good evening, everybody. Thanks for coming along to hear my presentation today. As I've just been rather embarrassingly introduced, I am Kerry Doherty, former curator at the Powerhouse Museum and now one of the management team of the Australian Space Discovery Centre in Adelaide. This presentation on women in space was originally prepared for World Space Week this year, which had the theme of women in space. Now, science fiction, going back to the very beginning of the 20th century, had a lot to tell us about what the role of women in space was supposed to be. Primarily, we were supposed to be sex objects. And for those of you not familiar with it, this is the original science fiction film of 1902, Georges Méliès' Trip to the Moon. And you can see that the spacecraft here being launched into a giant can, being assisted by these lovely French nymphettes. And right through from that point on, we see many vamps and, rather sexy ladies all the way through to Princess Leia, who, even though she was a strong leader in her own right, still winds up being portrayed as a sex object. And when women weren't being portrayed as specific sex objects, they were, of course, being presented as their other role as wives and mothers. We often see, for example, even women who are supposed to be competent scientists, like Professor Robinson, Maureen Robinson, in the TV show Lost in Space. But mostly we see her as a mother doing the washing and preparing the food rather than in a scientific role. Some of you may have seen the 1951 classic When Worlds Collide. This is one of the final scenes. 50 years later, in the movie Red Planet, we're still seeing exactly the same scene. Even though this woman is commander of the space mission, she's still the one seeing off her brave man on his mission to the surface of Mars. But despite the fact that those were the roles mostly given to women, we did, by the 1920s, even begin to see some very fine assisting in space exploration. For those of you who haven't or aren't familiar with it, this is the 1929 film Frau im Mond, The Woman in the Moon, by the German director Fritz Lang. Very famous film. It's the film that introduced the concept of the countdown into people's consciousness. The lady you see here is Frieda. She was the assistant to the space entrepreneur who financed the first mission to the moon. She travels to the moon as part of the journey and proves herself to be, in fact, more courageous than one of the entrepreneur's other assistants, and stays on the moon with her lover, the space entrepreneur, when it's not possible for all of them to go back to Earth in their damaged spaceship. By the way, the movie does have one very unscientific aspect in that it has air on the moon, but we'll just ignore that for the moment. Some other interesting early female characters. This is Marina from the Russian film Kosmicheski Race, or The Cosmic Voyage, who again proves herself, in fact, to be a lot more courageous than the professional astronaut who chickens out from taking a space trip in the spacecraft designed by her employer, a professor based very much on Konstantin Tsiolkovsky. But Marina goes along on that trip and proves herself to be every inch a worthy astronaut. In the 1950s, we start to see some professional women appearing, like Dr. Joyce Hendren, who's a developer of rocket fuels, and she appears in the 1951 classic Rocket Ship XM. Coming up into the 60s, science fiction television starts to give us some role models in Dr. Venus from the kiddie show Fireball XL5, one of my role models as a child, who was not only an astronaut but a doctor of space medicine and space psychology, and even winds up as the head of a space settlement mission. And of course, many of you will recognize Lieutenant Uhura from Star Trek, who was begins as a bit of a background character who mainly says hailing frequencies open, but by the end of the Star Trek series has become quite a significant character in the chain of command, one of the very important characters in the series. This lady that you see here in the photo of the GERD-10, which was Russia's first liquid fuel rocket launched in 1933. This is LN Kolbazina. She was actually one of the designers of this rocket, alongside a certain Sergei Korolev, who I'm sure many of you will know was the driving force behind the Soviet space program. Unfortunately, though, we only know her as LN. I have yet to be able to find what those initials actually stand for. But she was part of this, this early group involved in some very significant work in the early days of rocketry in the USSR. This young lady is Elizabeth Stewart, one of the Paisley Rocketeers, the Scottish of young people who did some a lot of interesting experiments with small rockets in the late 1930s before the Second World War. But after the war, we begin to see women playing a much more important role behind the scenes in the development of missiles and rockets, and that is as computers, human computers. Now, I'm sure many of you will have seen the movie Hidden Figures, and if you haven't, shame on you. It's a really good film, which tells the story of the black computer ladies who worked at Langley Research Center. And what they did essentially was the heavy duty number crunching in the days before the electronic computers as we know them now. They did all the sort of number crunching for the rocket tests, missile tests, calculating trajectories and so on. And particularly in the early days of the Mercury program, a lot of their work was very significant. And in fact, representing all the other lady computers of the day, Katherine Johnson was actually presented with a Presidential Medal of Freedom in 2015. She only passed away earlier this year at the age of, 101? So that's pretty amazing. The ladies you see here are this is the computing team from the Jet Propulsion Laboratory in Pasadena. So, of course, they were involved in a lot of the calculating, a lot of the trajectories for the very earliest American satellites and, of course, the early deep space missions. Here in Australia at Woomera, we also had computing ladies involved from 1949 when the first computing team was established. They performed a wide range of roles involved in both the missile and space work out at Woomera, things like reading all the data off filmed tests so that this would be projected on the screen. They'd take all the data or make all the measurements to take the data off those film records, and then they'd crunch the numbers early on with these, sort of electromechanical comptometers and calculators. They were involved in a lot of the work that actually made Australia, you may not know this, a world leader in the automation of data processing in the 1950s and early 60s. And many of the computing women were involved in that process. And in fact, what you can see behind them there is my favourite Australian computer, AGWAC, the Australian Guided Weapons Analog Computer, that was involved in a lot of early pioneering work on spacecraft, missile flight simulations. The women also did things like actually operating tracking instruments and making suggestions that were quite important in contributing to the tracking project. The vertical, the horizontal, I'll get my tongue around this yet, the diagonal that you see on several of the rockets launched at Woomera was actually an idea suggested by the computing ladies themselves, particularly Mary Whitehead, one of the leading computers, to enable better measurement of the roll angles of the rockets. And you've probably seen, in the US, of course, all the early NASA rockets have those black and white checks on them, which were for the same purpose. But apparently the diagonals here actually gave a better, more accurate reading of the angles. And of course, there were other women in more professional roles behind the scenes, again, very often not recognised initially. Perhaps one of the ones who in fact was Nancy Grace Roman, who you may know that name from a space telescope that NASA is going to be launching in a few years' time. But she was the very first female executive at NASA and actually ran their astronomy program from the 1960s through to the 1970s, and later went on to become involved in similar work at the Goddard Space Flight Centre in their looking after their astronomical data section. So very interesting lady, big contributions to NASA's work in space astronomy, and she's seen there with a model of the Orbiting Space Observatory, which is one of the observatories that she oversaw the development of in the 60s. Most of you, I guess, will be familiar with Margaret Hamilton, who did the work on developing the software for the Apollo program. And this pile of paper here is actually all the printout of the software that she developed for Apollo. And as you can see, it's taller than she is. This lady is someone that I was fortunate to meet before she passed away, Doris Jelly. She's an unsung hero of the Canadian space program and was responsible for developing, among other things, the particular type of extruded antennas that were developed for the early Canadian satellites. So this is, Alouette 1, the first Canadian satellite. And these antennas were actually rolled up as very fine, flexible steel tape. And then they were extruded once the satellite was in orbit to form these antennas. And this was something that she developed. Some of you may know Abby Alwood, who is an Australian astrobiologist who's been working with the Jet Propulsion Lab for many years. And she's actually got an instrument right now on the Perseverance rover. That's the Pixel instrument. You can look that up. It's some really interesting work she's been doing with the NASA Astrobiology Program. Carolyn Porco here, a planetary scientist and particularly an image specialist. All the wonderful images that you've seen coming back from anything since the Voyager program, she's been involved with in one way or another. So, and these, of course, are not the only women involved, but I've just selected them to give you an idea of the way that we don't hear in many cases about the work they're doing, but these women have been involved in quite a lot of significant accomplishments in the NASA programs and in the programs of other nations as well. And in fact, when we first started sending animals into space before human beings, many of those early animals were in fact female, because the females behaved better and were easier to keep calm in the confines of the spacecraft. Laika, the very first living thing in orbit, was a female dog. This is Miss Baker, who along with her companion Abel, two female monkeys that were the first successfully recovered from a United States missile test. She was flew a suborbital flight on a Jupiter missile back in 1959. And one of my favourites, Felicette, the French space cat, the so far only space cat who made a suborbital flight in 1963. And we see her here as the only female among the all-male team that was managing her mission. And to be honest, I sometimes felt like that when I was going to space conferences back in the early 1980s. There might be one or two women and everybody else would be a man. Now, some of you may have heard the story of the Mercury 13. This is often portrayed in a somewhat overblown way, that these women were, you know, tested by NASA and they were going to become astronauts and then were denied the opportunity. That's not exactly the story. These women were in fact part not of a NASA program, but of a private program operated by or put forward by Dr. Randolph Lovelace, who was a doctor who had his own medical clinic. He was involved in doing the work on the testing for the selection of the original Mercury astronauts. And he thought that it would be interesting to run a number of women through the same tests to see what kind of results they would give. So he brought together a group of 13 women pilots. In fact, the 13 never met as a group. They were tested usually a few at a time across several months at Lovelace's clinic. As I said, this was a privately organised program. But what it did do was demonstrate that women certainly had the same physical endurance, the same abilities as the men to operate in space conditions, and that if NASA had decided to undertake a female space program or recruit women into the astronaut program at this time, they could certainly have measured up to all the same physical requirements as the men. As it was, though, at that time, none of the women, even very experienced pilots like Jerry Cobb, had the necessary test piloting experience to qualify under the regulations that NASA had at that time. Now, of course, it is very easy to say that, yes, that's because the women weren't allowed to be pilots in the military, and that's very true. That was part of that wider cultural aspect that women were not seen as being able to handle those roles. And as we know, that that changed over time, and we'll come to how women first became part of the US space program a little bit later in my talk. But because they're often not seen, these are the Mercury 13 ladies. Many of them were very accomplished private pilots. Some of them had commercial pilot ratings. Some of the older ladies had actually been involved in ferrying military aircraft during the Second World War. So many of them were quite experienced and could almost certainly have gone on to, with additional training, to become quite competent astronauts. Sadly, of course, only one of them ever made it into space, and that is Wally Funk, who this year, on the 20th of July, actually flew on the first Blue Origin crewed flight as Jeff Bezos' special guest. So, and of course, I'm sure you saw the footage of her absolutely ecstatic when she returned from finally having made it into space. And for a short period, she was 82. At the short period, she was the oldest person to have made a space flight until William Shatner recently pipped her on the most recent Blue Origin flight. But what is interesting is that although, you know, the testing of the women was not an official NASA program, the Soviets actually thought that there was an intention, thought that NASA was going to develop a female space corps. And so as they were wont to do during this Cold War period, the Soviet Union decided that to prove the equality of women in the Soviet system, they'd better get in there first and have a woman fly in space. And so in 1962, they selected a small cadre of five women to train as cosmonauts. Now, none of these women were highly skilled as pilots. In fact, most of them weren't pilots at all. But what they were was parachutists and quite accomplished ones. Valentina Tereshkova, who was ultimately selected as the first woman in space, had been a parachutist since she was in her teens and was quite a champion parachutist. Now, you might wonder why the Soviets particularly focused on the parachuting skills. And that's because, as we now know, although we didn't then, Soviet cosmonauts in the Vostok program did not land in their spacecraft. They actually ejected out and landed separately from the spacecraft itself. In fact, the Vostok spacecraft was very highly automated, and in most cases, the cosmonauts had very little involvement in actually flying the spacecraft. It was remotely controlled from the ground. So piloting skills were not considered as necessary for the women as competent parachuting skills. But they went through essentially the same training as the men. Tereshkova and some of her colleagues going through some of the testing regimes. And Tereshkova was then selected as the first woman to fly as part of a joint mission, the Vostok 5 and 6 twin flight, as it's sometimes referred to. Although both the missions were in space at the same time and they were placed into similar orbits, they actually didn't have control over their spacecraft as we would see in the Gemini program, so that they couldn't perform a rendezvous and docking. But nonetheless, they were in space together. And here we can see Bykovsky, the pilot of the Vostok 5, and Tereshkova just after their return from their station. Now, the mission itself Tereshkova performed the same kinds of experiments and roles as the male cosmonauts, right down to the ritual of peeing on the tire of the bus when she arrived at the launch pad, which, of course, you may know, Gagarin did this before his first flight. So the cosmonauts, even today, still do that for good luck. So I'm not quite sure how Tereshkova actually managed this, but being slightly different anatomy to the men, but apparently she did. While she was in orbit, she sent back television broadcasts. Like the other cosmonauts, of course, she experimented with space food and various other scientific experiments on orbit. She did have some trouble with space sickness, but nothing overly debilitating. And after her safe return, along with Bykovsky, she was often pictured then with the rest of what was then the known cosmonaut team. It was always interesting though that although she had a nominal lieutenant's rank in the Soviet Air Force, she was always pictured in civilian clothes, where the men were always seen in their military uniforms. In the November after her space flight, which was in June of 63, she married Vostok 3 pilot Adrian Nikolaev, and they became the parents of the very first child, Elena, to be born of two spacefarers. And in fact, the very fact that Elena grew up as a normal, healthy young lady proved that travelling in space was not of itself detrimental to being able to raise a family, which was something that had been a concern early on, that the radiation effects might make the men or women sterile and unable to have children. Tereshkova became quite a propaganda tool for the Soviet system over the years. She was often sent on, diplomatic visits to other countries. And here, for example, we see her in India with Indira Gandhi. She went to often represented the Soviet Union at many international conferences. And even today, she's actually a member of the Soviet Parliament.